The only time I ever tried to run away from home, I was on a boat to Ireland. I was in the 8th grade, just about the time you start to get too big for your family, but are still too small, one hopes, to start your own. I was unhappily ensconced in what was said to be the largest junior high in the country at that time. The Traverse City Junior High gathered its 2,500 victims from the couple of dozen elementary schools in the area and funneled them into the Traverse City High School, which, because of its large pool of students, was one of the best regarded schools in the state. In sports, anyway. But really, what else was there to public education in Michigan? It was a giant shock going from my small, stable class of 30 sixth graders, almost all of whom had been with the same group of kids for their entire school career up to that point, and being thrown into a class with 750 other students. And not just other students, other seventh graders. Not that anybody has a particularly stellar time in junior high, but to have that many kids at that age all locked together just seems cruel beyond words. So, like millions of kids before and after me, I just kept my head down and tried not to draw too much attention to myself. It was a difficult time. Not only was there the whole ongoing crisis of puberty and hormones and self-esteem and unfamiliarity in my own body and, gulp, girls to deal with, but things at home weren't particularly rosy either. At least, not for me. My mom had just started seeing Frank, the last of her boyfriends, I hope, and the man she would later marry. Unfortunately, there was the slight inconvenience of him already being married and having a kid and another on the way. In a small, insular community like Interlaken, that kind of secret doesn't stay secret for long, but they did their best. And they absolutely forbade me from saying anything about it to anybody. Wanting to keep the peace, I did as I was told and played dumb about it, although they certainly didn't make it easy for me. Frank moved into an apartment in town. Traverse City, where the junior high was located, was about 20 miles from Interlaken. During the separation, and my mom would frequently pick me up from school and take us to his apartment for the night. Of course, she never bothered to bring a change of clothes for me or anything for me to do while they were trysting, and it was always awkward the next day at school when my friends asked where I was the night before and people made fun of the fact that I wore the same clothes to school 2 days in a row. But she didn't care. She was far too wrapped up in her dangerous liaison to pay much attention to a geeky 13-year-old and how this was all affecting him. Later, it occurred to me how I could have used the secret as leverage against them, but I was far too nice to do anything like that. Then, anyway. At any rate, spring was in the air, and my mom had been planning a big trip for me and her and Oma, her mother, to take during her 3-week break from the Interlaken Arts Academy. The The trip had been in the planning and saving stage for quite a while, so she went through with it, even though I suspect she'd have rather stayed at home with Frank. This is the kind of adventure we'd occasionally have. The three of us, the family matriarch, her only child, and her only child's only child, would go to Europe together, or drive through the original 13 colonies for an historic bicentennial orgy of patriotism.
I love Paris in the springtime.
In retrospect, it is amazing to me that my mom would even consider such a venture, traveling in tight quarters with her mother and her son for a couple of weeks at a time, especially since money was tight and we'd invariably spend most of it just getting to and from our ultimate destination, and then would have to scrimp and squeeze while we were actually there.
Do I love Paris? Because my love is near. How about Germany? Germany!
There was one trip to Europe when I was 9 or so in which we ate peanuts and orange tang that Oma had thoughtfully packed on a daily basis in order to stretch our food dollar. I haven't had a sip of the space-age orange drink since then, and I hope I never shall. For this particular adventure, we were bound for Britain, 2 weeks in London and a week in Ireland. I was what must have been irritatingly blasé about it. When my mom triumphantly announced the trip to me, I believe my response was, "I've already been to Europe." But I was at least glad we were going somewhere where the language wasn't going to be much of an issue. It wasn't a particularly pleasant trip for me, and I can't pretend it was much better for my mom and Oma. The biggest problem, really, was my age. When we had gone to Europe before, we'd invariably spend the day doing things I didn't want to do. The Louvre? Spare me. But I was too young to strike out on my own. This time, I was 13, and my folks were irritating me just by existing. To be trapped in a hotel room with them for 3 weeks was almost unbearable, especially since there were always only two beds and nobody really wanted to sleep with anybody else. In addition, Mom and Oma wanted to spend every day wandering museums and going to high tea, and every evening going to some mind-numbingly boring play in an attempt to cram as much culture into the trip as possible. I was going out of my skin. We'd be walking down the street, and I'd just want to go, and then I'd realize I was alone, and that the two of them had stopped to peer into the window of the Lace Emporium, Lasers, 2HRH, since 642, so I'd stomp back and try to get them back on track. After much prodding and whining and many pained sighs of disgust, we'd finally get to where we were heading, and it would turn out to be the Tate Gallery, or something equally thrilling. We'd spend the day walking and standing, and then go to some achingly boring drama in the evening. And I'd spend the entire performance desperately trying to stay awake, my head lolling and bobbing about. And as little fun as I was having, I'm sure that's just how much fun I was to be around. As far as I was concerned, I was a full-grown man and more than capable of handling myself, and I just wanted to be cut loose and explore the city on my own. Understandably, my mom was a little concerned about her 13-year-old country bumpkin of a son wandering the streets of one of the world's largest and most formidable cities alone. But, to her credit, she did bite her lip and let me go out a couple of times by myself. Once I slipped out during the intermission of some play to stretch my legs, and I was approached by a middle-aged man and asked if I wanted 10 pounds. I couldn't quite cut through his accent, so I asked him to repeat what he had said. He looked about nervously, cleared his throat, and asked again if I wanted 10 pounds. 10 pounds of what? I asked, which scared him off. Walking back to the theater, it dawned on me what had just happened, and I told my mom as I was settling back into my seat. She looked over at me worriedly, then said, "I hope you held out for 20. There was one accidental respite in all that forced culture. In purchasing theater tickets, my mom had inadvertently walked into the wrong building. Oh, you know how it is in the West End, all those theaters piled up on top of each other. And instead of emerging with seats for D.H. Lawrence Slowly Contemplates His Virginity, she ended up with tickets for Shag the Vicar. It was a breath of raunchy air in a carefully pruned garden of flowers, and I drank it in deeply, savoring the stench. By the time our 2 weeks in London were up, I had just about had it with them, and they with me. We took a train to the place where we could get an overnight ferry to Ireland. They sure didn't make it easy to get to that particular country, tellingly enough. We were all supposed to share one sleeping compartment, but it was mighty small, even by our standards, and I decided to walk around a bit and maybe sleep on one of the benches. After an hour or so, I came back and knocked on the door, having changed my mind. My mom opened the door, none too pleased to see me, and then shut the door in my face. I know that she had just shut the door to move stuff around so there would be room for me, but that was just the final straw. I had suffered these irritating adults who knew nothing and controlled everything long enough, and when the door closed in my face, I made sure that I wouldn't be there when it opened again. I went up to the lounge and crawled under a table to spend the night. My plan was to hide out there until we landed in the morning, and then slip off the boat undetected and go live my life the way it should be lived. The way I wanted to live. In, Ireland. Okay, so it wasn't the best planned, and fortunately, the trip was long enough for my resolve to soften by the time the sun rose and the boat landed. As the gangways were lowered, I caught the eye of my mom, and we slowly wandered back together. She silently received me back into the flock, and I, just as silently, acquiesced. Our time in Ireland was relatively uneventful, and the mood was a little better for having broken on the boat. My mom was having terrible back trouble at the time, so getting around was extremely difficult for her, but she soldiered on and we got to the end of our vacation alive. Then there was the matter of getting home. This should have been a simple, though time-consuming affair, but it quickly turned into one of the worst travel experiences of my life. Aer Lingus, our scheduled carrier, was on strike, so its flights were being handled by another airline, with much smaller planes. After innumerable delays, we finally boarded the plane several hours late. Right after takeoff, the pilot came on and explained that the reason we were flying so low is that there was something wrong with the pressurization system, but that we were going to make a stop, in Wales, I suppose, to get it fixed before we headed out across the pond. Very reassuring. They got that squared away after another long delay, and we were finally on our way home.
We come on the sloop, John B.
Because of the length of the flight, they were going to show a movie. Two movies, actually, but perversely, they showed them at the same time on alternating screens that had been pulled down into the aisle while they served dinner. Because the movies were shown on alternating screens, you got the sound for the screen directly in front of you. But directly in front of me meant, in this case, one seat, so my angle was so oblique I couldn't really see anything on the screen. But I could see the next screen just fine. Too bad I couldn't get the audio for that one. So I watched one movie, Benji, while listening to another, Charles Bronson's Telecon. It didn't really matter that the two didn't go together, because every time somebody walked down the aisle, they'd push the screen out of the way, and it would swing back into position for several minutes, giving you a bad case of motion sickness if you actually tried to watch what was being projected, which apparently was what the kid behind me was trying to do, and before long, he had thrown up all over the back of my seat. I had to quickly scoop up my carry-on bag to keep it out of the puke that started seeping under my feet. The odor was bad, and it kept me from eating my dinner, which is just as well, because there were lots of little green bugs crawling around in my salad. The smell of vomit quickly permeated the cabin, and some lady a couple of seats in front of us decided that the thing to do was to spray some perfume around to mask the scent. Too bad she dropped her brand new magnum of perfume, which shattered and soaked into the carpet, poisoning the plane for the next several hours.
Let me go home.
We finally arrived several hours late, just in time to run like maniacs through the airport and just barely miss our connecting flight back to Michigan. But I didn't care. I was so glad to get off that plane and back to the good old USA that I would have gladly slept on the floor of the airport, which, I'm sorry to report, did not happen. The airline put us up in a hotel for the night, and the next morning, feeling considerably better, my mom and I bid Oma farewell and made our way back to Interlaken. Now, you may be surprised after that litany of abuse, but that trip was, in some ways, the most important and exciting and successful trip of my life. Sure, there was all the adolescent tension and angst and all those endless hours in museums. The portrait gallery, why would they do that? And there was the time a newsstand owner almost called the cops when he caught me trying to steal a magazine.
In my yellow jersey, I went out on the nick. South Street, Rumford, shopping arcade. Got a Razzle magazine, I never paid. Inside my jacket, and away double quick. Good sense told me.
Listen to Ian Dury's wonderful Razzle in My Pocket for a reasonable facsimile of the experience. And not all the plays were terrible. I did get to go see Jesus Christ Superstar at its original venue, and there was the Naughty Accidental Farce, which was great lecherous fun. But there was something else that happened on that trip. Something wonderful and miraculous that changed my life forever and opened up new worlds for me. After hoofing my way through endless acres of museums, my mom took pity on me and asked if there was anything I'd like to do. I scanned the time out and found two things of interest, both involving lasers. Star Wars had just swept the world and me up in its arms. One was Laserium, which was playing at the planetarium, and the other was the Museum of Holography. We went to the museum first, and marveled at the incredibly not lifelike three-dimensional images trapped in the glass. It was uncanny the way you could walk around them and see different angles, but the fact that they were all red kind of gave the illusion away. Still, this was cutting-edge optics, and it was sort of interesting. In the final room was a programmable laser, just like they were using at Laserium, and every few minutes they'd have a little demonstration of it with some music playing. I don't remember what the demonstration was, other than it ended with a laser drawing the Guinness logo on the ceiling. But the music... Ah, the music... Up until this time, I was pretty uninterested in music. I heard lots of it, almost all classical, and it was nice and all, but it wasn't anything that had really captured my interest, despite, or because of, piano and viola lessons. But standing in that room that afternoon, watching the laser shill beer, I heard something that shook me deep in my soul, something that awakened me and made me realize that I had been sleeping for 13 years. I had never heard music like this. It was epic in scope and scale, and the sounds were entirely unrecognizable. I could identify no instruments, and the sweeping panorama of sound took my breath away. And then, in a moment, it was over. Intrigued, but clueless as to what that was and how to find more of it, I stumbled back out into the bright London afternoon and back to my ignorant bliss. The next day, our penultimate day in London, we went to Laserium. I was excited by the trippy sci-fi reputation and begged my mom to shell out the extra pounds so I could rent headphones for the show. My mom and Oma were as excited to be there as I was to go to high tea, so they skipped the headphones and took their seats, and I worked my way across the room to the section with headphone jacks and found a seat, plugged in, and started looking at the program. There was some interesting music on while people filed in, something vaguely familiar, something very like Dvorak's New World Symphony, played in counterpoint to Paul Winter's Icarus, but played on the synthesizer. I settled back in my seat while the auditorium filled up and waited for the show to begin. Then, in a moment of supreme serendipity, a moment I daily thank the gods for, a new piece of music started playing. There was an eerie swell of sound, a rushing of notes, a breathless crescendo of electronics, and then a gorgeous, epic theme started unfolding. Heart stopped. It was the piece from the Holography Museum. Transfixed and afraid to even breathe, I listened as the piece climbed and developed. The sounds, all electronic, were fantastic. There was such a visual element to the music. It sounded like you were boldly going into space on a heroic journey. I couldn't believe my ears. Gradually, the piece shifted and changed, and the grandeur and majesty of it gave way to something else. Something a little sinister, a little foreboding, but absolutely spellbinding. The piece gradually changed some more, now blossoming into a rich, almost Baroque counterpoint exercise, lines doubling and redoubling, layers and details added until an entire symphony orchestra's worth of sound was cascading over me. Except there was no orchestra. There were no conventional instruments. It was all electronic, and it opened up the back of my head, took my brain out, and put it back in upside down. Thank you. The piece shifted back to another eerie section and then exploded into a scorching, intense finale, like you had made it across the vast reaches of the universe and were now flying directly into a supernova. Faster and faster, higher and louder, the piece moved relentlessly on, gaining momentum until it exploded, leaving me pinned to my seat. Lights went out and the show started.
I have just closed my eyes again, climbed aboard the dream weave chain.
I remember almost nothing about the actual show. There were pretty lights, they made pretty pictures, there was some music playing, but none of that mattered. I had been fundamentally altered and I couldn't concentrate on anything else. A switch had been flipped in my brain and I'd never be the same again. When the lights came up an hour later, I looked down at my program and saw the list of songs that had been used for the show. And at the top, in small letters, it said, "Entrance Music, Sequencer, by Synergy." I got it. A clue. A line to follow. A beginning. I didn't know anything about Synergy or electronic music, but I was sure as hell going to find out. If there was music like this in the world, I wanted to hear more of it. We got home, and I saved my pennies until I had enough, and then I went to the local record store, the pathetic Camelot Music in the mall, to buy my treasured record. Surprisingly, they didn't have it and had never heard of it. I chalked this up to the fact that Synergy was British, or so I thought, since that's where I heard it. What I didn't realize then, but what would become painfully clear later on, was the reason they didn't have it and hadn't heard of it is because they were fucking morons. Well, no, that's not fair. They knew the charts, the whole charts, and nothing but the charts, and if it wasn't popular, they didn't know about it, and didn't want to, either. I had heard a fair amount of so-called popular music, and it really didn't interest me, so I really shouldn't have gone to the mall to find the music that moved me, but I was a complete musical neophyte and had to learn how unusual my musical tastes were the hard way. Eventually, that became, and remains, a point of pride with me. But it was disappointing to discover that, now that I had done the hard part and actually identified something I liked, that didn't mean I'd actually be able to find a copy. So I asked if I could order it. The clerk looked hassled and patronizing at me, but I didn't have any other options, and I wasn't going to abandon my quest that easily. So he slowly, reluctantly, looked up the record and said he'd put in an order and that I should call back and check in a couple of weeks. That was in 1978, and that record is still, I believe, on order. Eventually, summer came, and I took what was a fairly customary trip out to Seattle to visit Oma, my grandmother, and my dad. In order to make some money, those pennies got spent on something else when it became clear the record was never going to come in, I agreed to mow Oma's lawn. She offered me $10 to do it, but I was wary because of another $10 I had once made doing yard work and how much work there actually turned out to be.
I'm gonna raise a fuss. I'm gonna raise a holler.
But I jumped at the chance, since I had no others.
Just to try to earn a dollar.
Sure enough, there was more there than met the eye. The lawn wasn't that big, but Oma owned a push mower, and most of the lawn was on a steep bank that surrounded two sides of the house.
Nowadays, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Oma was very concerned about the appearance of her lawn, and I had already been scolded many times for sliding down the bank in my youthful exuberance, so I had to use the push mower to mow the bank without actually stepping on it. This proved to be nearly impossible. Either I stood at the bottom and tried to push the mower straight up the hill, not likely, or I stood at the top and tried to mow down the hill without the momentum taking the mower out of my hands and running it into the street. Also not very likely.
Now you can't use the car because you didn't work a lick.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Plus, when I hear mow the lawn, that's what I thought the job was. But when Oma said mow the lawn, she also meant trim the bushes and weed the flower beds and edge all the sidewalks and rake and sweep and so on and so forth. Eventually, however, I finished to her, sort of, satisfaction, and she gave me the money and drove me to Tower Records. The car hadn't stopped moving when I leapt out and ran into the store. I had never really spent any time in record stores, why would I, so I was a bit lost, but I saw a section in the back marked Import, so I made a beeline and started flipping through the S's. Imagine my heartbreaking disappointment to discover that there was no Synergy section. I thought I was going to cry. I had waited months holding the precious flame of my memory, and now, here I was, with money in hand, in a giant record store in a major city, and I couldn't find what I wanted. It just wasn't fair. As I was contemplating my bad fortune, Oma made it over to the racks and asked if I had found it. I shook my head sadly. No, I said, it isn't here. If it was, it would be right there. And I flipped past the Sylvester partition to show her the empty space where Synergy should have been. Only it wasn't empty now. In my haste, I had flipped right past it, for there, in neat black letters, was the word Synergy. My heart leapt into my throat. There were two records in the slot. With shaking hands, I picked up the first one. It had a strange psychedelic cover with what appeared to be melting buildings or something on it, and was called Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra. Holding my breath, I slid it back into place, and, hoping against hope, I picked up the second record and looked at it. The cover was very simple, just a close-up photograph of a red switch flipped on. Across the top, in the vibrating font used on the other album, was the word Synergy. And below it, across the bottom of the cover, was a single word, Sequencer. This was it. The Holy Grail. I had finally found it. Practically leaping out of my skin with excitement, I ran to the counter, nervously handed over my $10, as it was an import that was barely enough to cover it. The cashier nonchalantly rang it up and slipped it in a yellow bag with my receipt. He handed me the bag, smiled joylessly, and said, "Have a nice day." I grinned back at him maniacally, assuring him that I most certainly would, and pulled Oma out of the store so we could go home and I could listen to it. Oma talked to me on the way home, but I have no idea what she said. I stared at the cover, reading all the fine print, in blissful communion with the record. There were lots of little pictures of intriguing electronic equipment on the back, and the entire album seemed to have been put together by just one guy, somebody named Larry Fast from New Jersey. We finally got home, and I leapt out of the car and ran into the house and put the record on the turntable, fired it up, and put the needle down on the last track, called Sequence 14. Like much synergy, great track, terrible title. I knew I should probably listen to the record in order, but I also knew that the last track had to be what I heard in London, for it was the only one long enough, 11 minutes and 14 seconds, to match what I remembered. There's this thing that often happens when you see something remarkable, or you eat a fantastic dish, or you hear a piece of music that blows you away and then you don't see, eat, hear it for a long time. Your memory, which always tends to make things better than they were anyway, starts to embellish, and pretty soon it becomes the most spectacular movie, burrito, song that you can possibly imagine. Then, if you get the chance to experience it again, you are almost invariably disappointed. My mom once choreographed a dance piece based on her memory of an impressionist painting she had seen in a museum in Detroit. I was with her months later when she finally made it back to that gallery, and she was absolutely crushed that the painting wasn't nearly as evocative as she had remembered it, and she almost wished she hadn't bothered to look it up again. After all these months of waiting and anticipating and imagining and remembering, there was every reason to believe I was going to be disappointed by what was really there. I'm overjoyed to report that that is not what happened. As soon as the piece started, I got goosebumps all over, and the music picked me up and carried me out to the edge of the galaxy, just like it had those many months before. I sat at the piano, as it was the closest seat to the speakers, and I put the record jacket on the music stand where I could study it and let the music have its way with me. I was profoundly, deliriously, unspeakably happy. Eventually, I made my way through the whole album, and was, and still am, amazed at both the sounds and the music. The music was often quite intricate, almost baroque, with intertwining lines and sophisticated harmonies and phrasing. The album was well titled, as much of the music was made from sequences weaving together into dense sonic tapestries.
In fact, the long piece that had first turned me on so much was called Sequence 14, and it is a set of theme and variations built on a strange 14-note sequence in 7-4. But it was really the sound that captivated me. Most musicians are drawn to music because they are fascinated by the qualities of sound. The sonic palette that Synergy used was glorious and enticing. I had heard synthesizers before, a little pop flourish here, a switched-on Bach there, but the sound was largely thin and gimmicky. These sounds were different. They had meat on them. They sparkled and swirled and shimmered delightfully. Debussy said something to the effect that the century of airplanes needed a new sound, and he went about expanding the palette of tone colors composers could use. Well, we were way beyond airplanes now, having landed a man on the moon a few years earlier, so it was time for an even more adventurous palette, and Larry Fest was all too eager to supply it. For Synergy is Larry Fest. Although he very occasionally used other musicians to fill out his sound, Pete Sobel is credited with playing a guitar synthesizer on a later record, and Ron Howden of Nektar is credited for supplying invaluable percussive aid, whatever that means, on Sequencer. Virtually every note and timbre on the Synergy albums was created from scratch by Larry Fast. Although he is not well known, Fast created the modern sound of the synthesizer and did more than anybody to bring it out of the closet of novelty and give it its rightful place in the pantheon of instruments. Although synthesizers and tone generators had long been studied in academic environments, the music that was created on them, that is, solely electronic music, was largely an academic pursuit, and a lot of the early electronic music sounds like it. The other side of the coin was, of course, using the synthesizer to make goofy sounds or as a little frosting over more established instrumentation. Fast gave the synthesizer dignity and proved it could stand on its own and didn't need support from other instruments. And the music that could be made on them could be enjoyed emotionally and viscerally instead of just intellectually. He gave the synthesizer heart and soul. Unfortunately, by accident or design, he is a pretty obscure character, and there are few outside the circle of passionate enthusiasts and professional musicians who know who he is or how much he contributed. Thank you. Fast had a classical music background, which he brought to bear on his compositions, which can be quite elaborate in their structure and form. But he also is an engineer and designed and built many of his instruments. This duality served him well. In one of the few interviews I was able to find with him, he talked about how these two different interests really helped him. When he got stuck musically and couldn't squeeze out any more notes, he turned his attention to designing or modifying existing equipment and circuitry. And when he started to feel too much like an electrical engineer, he'd put his soldering iron down and go back to the keyboard. He was enormously talented in both areas and brought a depth and richness to electronic sounds that had previously been lacking. Even now, over 20 years later, when most of his contemporaries' music sounds thin and reedy, his tones stand up. In fact, if you buy a new synthesizer, many of the pre-programmed sounds are direct imitations of sounds he created. My Alesis synthesizer even comes with a preset called Synergy. Although, to be fair, it also has an Eno pad and an Emerson saw, named not after the college, but after Keith, the E in ELP. Fast's Synergy albums were largely inspirational to a select group of musicians, who then carried the ideas further. The records themselves were never that publicly popular. Where Fast did make an impression on the public was by supporting Peter Gabriel for his first three albums. Fast was Gabriel's synthesist and created much of his sound, and lots of people were intrigued by the murky modern textures of that, so Fast got a fair amount of session work because of his reputation. Again, he, as a personality, was still in the shadows, but his sound was changing the sound of popular music. He was hired by musicians as vastly different as Hall & Oates, Barbra Streisand, and John Denver. In one memorable session, the hugely popular rock band Foreigner hired the two leading lights of synthetic creativity, Larry Fast and Thomas Dolby, to fill out their radio-friendly ballad, Waiting for a Girl Like You, a session which Dolby marveled at because it took as long to lay down a couple of lines for one song as it took him to record his entire and wholly superior album, The Golden Age of the Wireless. If there was nothing on Sequencer but Sequence 14, it would still be a colossal album. But there's much more. The opening track is an intricately layered confection called S-scape, which is followed by the gorgeous Chateau. The album also includes a fantastically exciting and brilliantly arranged version of Mason Williams' Classical Gas, which Fast makes so much of his own that I literally could not imagine it being played on a guitar, even though that is its original form. The track that leads into sequence 14, which is what I heard as I took my seat in London, really is a combination of the New World Symphony and Icarus. Fast plays glorious arrangements of each, and then plays them both at the same time. The way they fit together is positively uncanny. Because this is the track right before The Holy Relic, I still get shivers when I hear the end of it, knowing what's coming next. Only The Pedestrian Cybersports keeps this album from achieving perfection, although I am sorely tempted to award it that honor because the other tracks on it are so far and above anything else I've heard. Ever. After absorbing Sequencer, I went back to Tower, Grass Keeps Growing, and picked up Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra, the first and, at that time, only other Synergy album. By then, I had figured out that Synergy was not British, Fast was from New Jersey, not Old Jersey, and I picked that album up at a friendlier domestic price. Since I bought Sequencer as an import, I have come to know it by a different cover than what was released stateside, and I'm grateful for that. The US version is a gaudy, faux surrealist painting that is cheesy as all hell. I much prefer the British version, which is framed on the wall of my studio, where I can look at it every day and be reminded of what's really important in this world. Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra is another fine album, although not quite as polished as Sequencer. In addition to a number of originals, it also features a lengthy interpretation of Richard Rodgers' Slaughter on 10th Avenue, an admittedly unusual piece to realize electronically. With these two albums under my belt and an insatiable appetite, I was well on my way. I started hanging out at the Seattle Lazarium, trying to follow the path laid out by Synergy. I had zero musical knowledge and had to follow any lead, no matter how faint or ultimately fruitless it turned out to be. Since Lazarium is where I first heard Synergy, that's where I went for further inspiration. Through that venue, I stumbled across Jean-Michel Jarre and Vangelis and was on my musical way. I also started pursuing other leads. If Fast was the synthesis for Peter Gabriel, then Peter Gabriel needed to be listened to. If some guy from Nektar gave Fast some invaluable percussive aid, then Nektar needed to be listened to. And if Fast showed up on an obscure all-star sci-fi concept album called The Intergalactic Touring Band, well, then that had to be listened to as well. As I soon discovered, in order to have a good record collection, you have to buy a lot of crap. This was especially painful because I didn't have a lot of money and I couldn't buy records very often. My mom had recently instituted a new allowance, designed to allow me to go to the movies once a week if I so chose, although I was therefore supposed to pay for the movies I wanted to see. I got $10 a month, which would get me into 4 movies, those were the days, and then I'd have to wait a month for the next payment. Well, fuck movies. I immediately took my allowance to the best record store in town. Unfortunately, it was a small town, but I had learned to stay away from Camelot Music and found a couple of better options downtown, and spent it all in the first couple of days of the month on a new album. Going to buy my monthly album was a moment of supreme joy and crushing agony. After all, I could only buy one album, generally, two if I got lucky and found a couple of promising cutouts, and that had to sustain me for a month. I would often spend an hour in the store, holding 2 or 3 records and debating their perceived merits until I finally picked one and took it home. As frustrating as those early days were, nothing worse than blowing your month's wad on a piece of trash, I really knew my collection back then. Because I could only get one record a month, I gave that record lots and lots of chances, playing it dozens of times before that month was up and I could go back to the store. I knew my collection inside and out, to the point that once I was playing Name That Tune with my high school friends Eric and Alan, and I was able to name the song before it had even started because I recognized the surface noise that preceded the track. It was the single of ELO's I'm Alive from the notoriously campy Xanadu film starring Olivia Newton-John, as though anybody cares. I'm alive, and the world shines for me today. Because I had so relatively few records, I gave each of them lots of chances, and much music grew on me because of that. Now, with a couple thousand CDs and records, I'm much less patient with new material, and I don't know my collection at all. There are dozens of discs you could pull out and play for me, and I'd have no idea what they were. Grabbing those good years again. That was not the case back then. There's a very good chance that I never would have picked up on Peter Gabriel if I hadn't been forced to listen to it so many times, because I had so little else to listen to. Gradually, my ear was stretched out to accommodate his sound, and that, as I have stated elsewhere, has made all the difference.
Excuse me, I'm not the man I used. crept in again. I wanna be alone.
My summer in Seattle ended, and I came back home with my new treasures, a man transformed. Now I had a mission. Now I had a passion. That it was a passionate mission that nobody I knew really appreciated or understood, that many would often make fun of me for, bothered me not a whit. The music brought me so much pleasure that I couldn't be concerned with whether anybody else understood it or not. And here I learned another supremely valuable lesson. I learned that there were things words could not do. There were places in the heart where language had no reach. This music did something to me that was entirely beyond my ability to verbalize. And it wasn't, as I discovered, because I lacked the appropriate vocabulary. There was something there that could not be explained, or, more fundamentally, could not be understood in terms of words. It was then that I learned that words are a tool for communicating, but in some cases, a pretty poor one. That if words were capable of successfully communicating everything you'd need to communicate, then that's all there would be. There would be no art, no music, no theater. We wouldn't need them. But the fact of the matter is, we do need them. Words describe reality, but they are not reality itself. The map is not the territory. We need other ways to communicate, more subtle, more universal, more general, and more specific ways.
Leave me alone. I want to be alone. I want to be alone.
And that is why we have music and art and dance to communicate that which cannot be spoken. Every month when I went into the record store, I picked up more nonverbal vocabulary. I stretched my emotions. I became more human and more spiritual at the same time. My intellect, which had always been the source of my greatest pride and support, was starting to take a back seat to my emotions, to my soul, to that which I felt inside, to the music that was pouring in and starting to trickle back out. The next Synergy album, Chords, came out right after I got back from Seattle, while the awkward dance with Frank was in full swing. I held on to that album like a lifeline. My mom and Frank were too absorbed in each other and the ramifications of their actions to pay much attention to me, and many was the night and weekend I spent in Frank's modest apartment, plugged into the stereo, memorizing every note and sound on Chords. The headphones helped me disappear into the music and helped make me disappear from the apartment so my mom and Frank could be alone. So I was enthusiastically encouraged to listen to the headphones as much as I liked, and it became a sustaining friendship for me when there weren't many others around. Music, in a fundamental way, was becoming a home for me, a place I could relax and that gave me nourishment, no matter where I actually was. Chords was a strange and disturbing album, much different in texture from the first two. It was darker and more foreboding, and used a harsher sonic palette. The gorgeous orchestral richness of the first two albums was replaced with a more stark, more severe, more patently electronic sound. The album is very percussive in many places, and utilized unusual time signatures and drastic dynamic shifts. I wasn't quite sure I liked it, but that was sacrilegious to me, being Synergy and all, so I stuck with it and came to appreciate it, although never as much as Sequencer. But then, I don't think I'll ever appreciate anything as much as that, the foundation upon which my entire collection and, to a large part, my personality rests. Disruption in World Communications is my favorite track on the album, followed closely by Phobos and Deimos Go to Mars. Larry Fast wisely gave the chore of naming the tracks for the album to the much more capable Peter Gabriel. It is wonderfully creepy and foreboding, and explodes into terrifying passages that sound like nothing so much as a giant robot going berserk and destroying Tokyo. It's always Tokyo that gets destroyed, isn't it? And as exhilaratingly devastating as the sounds are, the music is astonishingly complex, switching meters dozens of times throughout its relatively short duration. In fact, I've listened to it what must be thousands of times by now, and there are still a few sections that I can't count out properly. God knows how he was able to write it, let alone record it. It is a darker, scarier synergy, crackling with energy and edgy with menace, but it was perfectly in tune with my emotions at the time, and I took great comfort in it. By the next album, Games, even I was willing to admit that the music wasn't as good anymore. Some of it was that by that time I had a lot more to compare it to, but it really isn't nearly as good a package as those that came before it. Because Synergy was what it was, I also bought the mail order only Computer Experiments album, which offered a couple of early computer-generated compositions, and which belong firmly in the academic realm, and is really tiring to listen to. Just when I was about to lose faith completely, Fast released Audion, a gorgeous album that returns to his rich orchestral compositions. For a while, Audion became the album of choice for my friends and I to get stoned to. So rich and tasty were its textures, so soothing were its sonorities. Fast eventually stopped releasing records under the Synergy name entirely, after the disappointing Metropolitan Suite. He briefly ran an electronic music label, Audion, but that disappeared fairly quickly, although it did bring out a couple of wonderful albums by Gary Hughes, who would later resurface in Euphoria. It is impossible to overstate the influence Synergy has had on me and my development, not just musically, but as a person. I was so infatuated with Synergy that I once wrote a letter asking Larry Fast if I could become his unpaid apprentice. He never responded. Curiously, years after Synergy and Audion ceased, he showed up writing some music for a low-budget straight-to-video horror film company called Full Moon. And it was Full Moon that did accept me as an unpaid apprentice in the editing department and started me on my path to becoming the editor I am today. Synergy opened me up to a whole new world, the world of music, and my life and soul would be impossibly impoverished if it wasn't for that beautifully intricate, gorgeously layered music I had heard by chance all those years ago, watching a laser spell out Guinness. Synergy was the different drummer that set me marching on my own path, unconcerned and uncaring where everybody else went, confident in my ability to find that which could sustain me. Synergy showed me the power of music, the darkness that it could unleash, the comfort that it could dispense. My relationship with music is the most beautiful, most sustaining relationship in my life, the only one that has never let me down. It reaches deeper into me than anything I have experienced, far deeper than any words can go, and it has immeasurably enriched my life. Synergy showed me that there was more to life than met the eye, and more to me than I could ever explain to anybody, even myself. It showed me, truly, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.